You're listening to the Drummers Education Connection Podcast. Interviews with the greatest drummers in the business and roundtable discussions with industry leaders and teachers from around the globe to help provide performance, insight, and inspiration.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Welcome and welcome back to the Drummers Education Connection. We are here with we are honored today to have a very special guest with us, Todd Sukerman. Ladies and gentlemen, please give him a warm welcome. Thanks for coming on our show, Todd.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's great to be here, and thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, thanks for doing this, Todd. This is
fantastic. As usual, we are here with Bart Robley from Southern California, Chip Ritter is in Tucson, Arizona, two of the greatest drummers and teachers around. And then our fourth compatriot is not able to be here today, Rick Stojak. We wish him well, and we'll see him next week. He's out of commission for today. For those of you who like what we do and are supporters of the Drummers Education Connection and the content that we bring you every week, we have a Patreon page. You can check it out. Help us keep the lights on. Help us bring on these great guests because, you know, Todd gets a really big check from this episode.
It's costing us an arm and a leg,
man. Exactly. So check out our Patreon page. And then also we have a very special event coming up on April 20th, our second in-person event. It's a clinic day called Deck Day, and it's going to be here in San Rafael, California. And it's going to be four clinics with each of us and a presentation on cymbals from Jason Slota of Round Sound Cymbals, Mike D'Amico of Brooks Drums will be there talking about how he makes his drums, and it's going to be a great hang. So we hope you can check us out there. Chip will put the link in the comments. And we'd like to start our show off with a quick segment we call Good Things, and this is just a chance for us to check in each week and see what's going on and focus on the good stuff that's happening in our lives. Could be musical, could be anything. So Chip, I'm going to kick it to you, man. What's happening?
Not much. I just did a show with Neiman Lyles at the Tono Onum Gardens, and there was a stage in the middle, and people sat all around in the patio all in front of us, on the sides of us, and behind us. It was kind of weird. Practiced all the songs as much as I could and got everything as ready, and then he handed me a set list with a whole bunch of different songs that I had no idea what they were. And I played great. I listened, I kept my ears and eyes open, and I faked my way through the whole thing, and nobody knew, and I did a great job. So I'm happy about that.
Well done. Excellent. Bart, how about you, bud?
You know, as usual, Sam Morrison Band, we're super busy. Just got home a couple nights ago, leave again tomorrow morning. We have a 5-night residency in Laughlin at the Celebrity Theater Don Laughlin's Riverside Casino. So I'm looking forward to that. It's kind of a working vacation, one load in, one load out, and I got to be responsible for 80 minutes. So I'm looking forward to that. So it's going to be nice. Might give a couple of lessons while I'm out there, but it's going to be a little bit of a reprieve. What about you, Jeremy? What's happening with you, bud?
Two albums coming out. Very excited. One's Mophone, my trio of two saxophones and drums. We just released our fourth album. Have another one in the pipeline with Erica Oba Trio, this terrific jazz piano player. So super excited about those. And big news, my kid got into Northwestern, UNT, USC, and Oberlin. Yeah. And most of those were full rides. So we're super excited. He's a terrific jazz piano player. And at this point now, it's down to making a decision. He's going to college, and we're excited. So.
That's awesome. Congratulations. Good for him.
Thanks.
May I vote for Northwestern because I grew up right near there, and the campus cannot be beat. It's on the lakefront, and there's paths and trees and the lake. It's spectacular.
You know, we went to visit, and I was totally seduced by the campus. They have the state-of-the-art performance arts center, performing arts center, with a stage with Lake Michigan behind it through the glass, and it's stunning, and it's a great school. So he's actually leaning toward Northwestern.
And I think at least is Paul Wertico still teaching there?
No.
Okay. I know he was for a while.
You know who I think on drums is Willie Jones the III? Does that ring a bell? Yeah.
Vaguely, but I've been gone for so long, but I mean, I've known Paul forever. Yeah. So.
Anyways, we're excited for him. Todd, what's happening with you, man? What's going on?
Goodness gracious. Just ended a run of shows with the band, came home, had my 21st wedding anniversary with my wife.
Congratulations.
My daughter's going to be in a TV show that I signed an NDA that I can't talk about. So they're leaving in a few days to fly to an undisclosed location. I came right into the studio here and did tracks for a client in Minneapolis, two for a client in Canada, and did this guy's record in Switzerland It's going to be called Enharmonic Confusion. And Michael Sadler, the singer from Saga, is going to be doing vocals on that. So it was kind of a, you know, European prog with all sorts of different influences from Steely Dan to Toto and whatnot. So it was fun. So it was hit the ground running, you know, here. And then I leave again on to go on the road on Thursday. So all good things.
Fantastic. Fantastic. That's really great. Speaking of Toto, I saw a post on your Facebook feed honoring Jeff Porcaro. It was his birthday the other day. We had Robin Flans on a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about her new book about Jeff, which is fantastic. For those of you guys who haven't checked it out, check out Robin Flans' books. She's got two of them about Jeff. And even though you never met him, you said you were a huge fan and had learned a lot from him. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't like Jeff Porcaro, you don't like ice cream. It's as simple as that. As I get older, I'm even more mystified by just hearing a simple groove, you know, whether it's him, you know, Gad or Steve Jordan. And I go, how do they do that? Mm-hmm. I know what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
But how did they do that? And, you know, and whenever Jeff's name comes up in my master classes, I always try to remind students, I'm like, Roseanne is awesome. And when I say this, I'm not dissing Roseanne. I mean, it's an all-time classic. But Pamela is the one to me that's maddening because his snare drum is so far behind. It's like it's in the past. Mm. Yet the song has a continual jab, like a punch in the chin, every bar. And this was before the digital age where you could take things and slide them a grain of sand here. Like he recorded that to tape. And, you know, I'm about to be 55 and I've had that record since I was 19. I still don't know how he did that. And I still try to play along with it. And it's like, nope. That's going, nope. It's absolutely maddening. And I'm surprised that more people aren't sort of keying in on what that track and that song hasn't been anywhere near the same talking point that Roseanne has been. Maybe Roseanne happened, you know, several years earlier. But yeah, Pamela is the one for me. That's maddening. But anyway, Jeff, you know, he continually inspires me, and I try to think about him sometimes, you know, when the red light's about to get pressed, I'm going to play. I really wish I would have gotten the chance to meet him or see him play at a certain point, or at any point in my life. But there's a little hole in me. That never happened, and for what he's meant to me. So anyone that got to see him or shake his hand or make music with him, you're a lucky person.
Right on. Yes,
that's awesome. I got to meet you, Todd, in person at your master class over at Rockstars of Tomorrow over here in Norco a few months ago, and I really enjoyed the class. I learned so much from it, and your dedication to the craft of drumming. When you talk about Jeff Porcaro and passing that legacy on, is that something that is that you try to work into your master classes ever, or into your clinics and stuff like that, by talking about drummers from the past?
Well, there's certainly an element of being a musician and music making and making the right choices, and he's a beacon for that. Mm-hmm. So I've always been into education, but there's something happened in this very room. Boy, back around 2006, there was a guy who was from overseas that was over here and took a lesson from me. And he could play all these complicated things, wanted to play in 1916 and could, you know, twirl the sticks and go, but he literally could not play four bars of Simple Time without it either sucking or him stymieing and go, oh, wait. And I thought, who's going to want to play music with this guy?
Right.
Set himself up for a lifetime of disappointment. Mm-hmm. So even though I've always liked, you know, chops and blah, blah, blah and whatnot, there's a time and a place. You know, Steve Gadd can rip your face off with chops, but he could also play the simplest groove and it's the greatest thing you've ever heard. So there's always some sort of reference to Jeff, you know, or Gadd or Steve Jordan or Carlos Vega or whatever, predicated on making musical choices and and being an employable drummer and studying the right things. I mean, if you want to work on, you know, 7/3 with your left foot and 5/2 with your right foot, and, you know, that's fine. The more you know, the more you know, and that's cool. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. you know, you're not going to be paying your auto insurance.
Yeah.
From doing that. So yeah, we become what we practice. So it's more of a way of trying to focus what is important. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to play Keep It Greasy by Frank Zappa, but you can't play Fire and Rain by James Taylor, you need to maybe think about what's important and what's going to make you employable and desirable from other musicians.
So. Absolutely. Yeah, this is a theme that's come up repeatedly on our show as we talk to great drummers and talk amongst ourselves. I always like to say that with great chops comes great responsibility. You know, there's a time and a place, but boy, it better be serving the music, and that's sort of the primary goal all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it comes up because it's true and will never not be true. So it's just a matter of reinforcing that to maybe some younger drummers who are dazzled by the wrong things.
Right.
Now look, it's a whole big world out there, and when people want to do, you know, they want to light their hair on fire and whatever, that's absolutely fine. There is an element to entertainment to this ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want other people to want you to participate in their music and looking to you for your input or solutions to their musical problems, that's a thing that really, really excites me. If I'm playing on a track and someone goes, "Man, I wasn't sure if this was going to work, and you made it work." That's mm-hmm. the greatest compliments,
right?
Because they sat with a piece of music for however long, whether it was 6 months or 6 years, and they were on the fence with their programming or maybe with what another drummer had to offer. And then if I'm able to do something, and they go, "That's it," and you breathe life into it, that's the greatest for me. That's cooler than, you know, ripping 64th note double bass triplets through a 4-bar phrase, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I have a question for you in regards to practice then, because I saw a post a while ago that you had put up on Facebook about how, well, everybody else is practicing, so I'm going to sit down and practice. And then you had a video. So therein lies the question. When you're just sitting there by yourself and you're like, I need to work on X. Granted, it could be for a song or something like that, but what do you just practice when it's just you playing, when you just want to sit down and work on something? What do you do?
Well, luckily, I don't have much of an opportunity to do that because I'm normally preparing for something.
Right.
There's always recording sessions in the queue that I got to do. And I like to learn them because I employ an engineer and he's on the clock. So if I'm pretty well prepared, I can normally bang things out in, you know, 1-3 takes. So most of that budget stays with me instead of going to my recording engineer. But when I come out here and practice, one exercise that I often do is I'll sit and I'll immediately start to play some sort of musical theme or some sort of idea, and then try to develop that and come up with a B section. And then come back and try to remember, what did I play for the A section? Come back and do that, and then maybe do a little bridge. And that helps keep my practicing in a musical context, insofar mm-hmm. as just coming out here and maintenance practice, playing repetitive and starting out with rolls. Now, very often I will warm up that way, but sometimes mm-hmm. when I come out here, I will warm up by playing just a simple melody on the drums, whether it's dun 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 dun, you know, whatever it is. Come up with a theme and try to develop something out of it. And that gets my juices, you know, sort of going in a musical context when I come out here. And then if I want to, I can do that, but I don't want to start with that.
Composing really is what you're talking about. Yeah.
Attempting to, sometimes cool ideas happen, and sometimes not so much. You know, that's the way it goes.
Do you record your practices when you're doing that?
Very often I do, mm-hmm. and it's a painful, laborious thing to do sometimes, but also sometimes you might catch
right
50 seconds of something like, oh that was nice. I didn't realize I played that.
Mm-hmm. Or, right.
You know what, if I do that and I do something else to it, that so it's a good idea to do it. It's time consuming, but it's the best way to get in touch with how you sound on the instrument is listening to it. And generally trying to do it later in the day. This is the tricky part. Trying to do it later the same day so you could really remember where you were at.
Okay.
And that means you have to have time to do that. Now, as we get older and we have kids and responsibilities, that's where it gets hard. You got to find that time. But I sometimes don't want to listen to something that I did 14 days ago, because I can't get in the mind space of where I was to remember it. It sort of has to be within 24 hours for it to mean anything to me. Anyway, that's how it works with me.
It makes sense. I mean, because it's fresher. It's more like, it's not in the moment, but it's kind of, I was just there a few minutes ago type of thing. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And listening to something from long ago is even less interesting to me. I just watched that Steve Martin documentary that's on Apple TV. And there's a scene in the second episode where he puts in a cassette tape of a stand-up thing that he did from like the late 70s. And he listens to two bits and he just goes, I can't take it anymore.
Yeah.
Sort of how I feel about listening to something too far removed. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I understand that. I totally get that. Let's go down this road now for a little bit. How long have you been in Styx? Okay. How long have you been the drummer for Styx? And I've read the story a few times, but for our viewers that don't know, how did you get into Styx? What was it that, how did you get into the band?
Well, in the early 90s, I started doing a lot of recording sessions in Chicago, and a good portion of those were jingles, which is music for television and radio commercials. And Chicago is sort of like the mecca for jingles. And back in those days, there'd be 20 plus music houses that all hired musicians. And it was a great, it was a really exciting time. I caught the last bastion of the old days.
Yeah.
So there's a guy named Keith Marks who handled cartage for all the musicians that were working. And cartage is a guy who would come to your house, take your drums, set them up at the studio just how you like it. You go in, you play, you sign the form to get paid, you leave. He tears the drums down, brings them back to your house, puts them right where they were.
Wait, do you have his number? Because
well, he's in LA now, actually, but he was the guy that, you know, worked with everyone, and he worked with the guys in Styx in the past, and a few of the guys on their solo stuff. So in 1995, Styx was going to, or A&M Records was going to release the definitive Styx greatest hits. Now, Styx's first hit, Lady, was on Wooden Nickel Records, a different record label. And I guess in those days, they couldn't get the rights to the original sound recording. So they figured, well, let's just re-record the song Lady and put it on the greatest hits. And in that time, Styx's original drummer, John Panazzo, was in ill health and kind of couldn't physically play the drums. So they called Keith and they said, who should we get? And Keith recommended me for the session, which was a ghost drum for John. I had to sign a form. I couldn't talk about it, and one-time payment. And That was it. You know, hey, I saw you guys in 81 and 83, you know, I had the records, great to meet you. And off I went. I was in and out of there in, you know, an hour. Hmm. And then they called me back again in February of 96. There was going to be Greatest Hits Part 2 on A&M Records. And they were recording a new song. And this time I could tell I was being vetted. Not that they weren't nice the first time, but there was much more of a, you know, asking me about where I grew up and sort of a get to know you. And they were feeling me out as a person. And in my memory, anyway, it was like a day or two later, James Young, JY, called me and said, what are you doing this summer? You know, John, he can't tour right now. The gig's his if he gets better. But, you know, would you be into doing it? And I'd never done a big rock tour before. I was doing, you know, I was doing 20, 30 sessions a month in the studio. I didn't want to go on the road. But for that, I thought, I want to have this experience, because I had the records growing up they were a Chicago band. I grew up in Chicago. They're on the radio all the time. You couldn't ignore them. You know, hometown heroes. And so I said yes. And I'm glad that I did, because it was really within 24 months, the recording industry in Chicago is like the Titanic. And the ship was going up like this. So I sort of leapt off the Titanic onto the Styx lifeboat. And really, I mean, I mean this seriously. When we finished that first tour in September 21st, 1996, I thought I'd never see any of those people again. I hugged them goodbye with the thought of, this was great. This was a summer fling. I'm never going to see these guys again. And then they called back the next year for another summer tour. And so this one summer fling turned into basically the last 28 years of my life now.
Wow.
Man, that's cool.
Big bulk of it, yeah.
That's fantastic. How many records, how many albums have you done with the band?
Oh, God, I actually have to count on my hand now. Proper records would be, well, the live record that came out in 97 from the 96 tour. The one in 99. I can't think of the name now. Brave New World, Cyclorama, Big Bang Theory, The Mission, the two Regeneration re-records, Crash of the Crown, which did go to number one in the Billboard Rock chart. So that was a first, career first. And then whatever different compilations that they came out with over the years, and the record companies doing different live stuff. Arch Allies is live record. I don't know. Sorry for the most answer to that question. Between 11 and 17.
It's hard to plan 11-17. one of the that's one of the things we do here on the show. We just, you know, shoot from the hip. We never like plan any interviews out, because I think it's better to have an interview like this where we're just asking questions than, hey Todd, what was it like going, you know, I mean, nobody wants to see that. So that's great. That's amazing. So it's not even something you planned on. It just, here, this happened for you. This is, you know, I mean, you obviously prepared for it. I don't mean it that way, but this is just the way the path led you. That's amazing.
I mean, for me anyway, when people ask me, like, you know, how do you get gigs or how do you get work? All I could go is by my experience and the things that happened to me. Like, I always felt that if I put all my eggs in one basket in a band, that I'm putting my future, you know, in the hands of, you know, three other knuckleheads. And that always made me nervous.
Yep.
I always thought it'd be easier to control my own career path and try to remain busy doing all sorts of different things, mm-hmm. with as many different musicians as possible. And if I was reliable and, you know, was pleasant to be around and did everything right, that eventually, you know, these circles of people would get higher and higher. Mm-hmm. And that's was my experience. So, you know, I was always on time. I mean, that means being devastatingly early.
Yeah.
I was always prepared. I showed up to every gig or every new situation with the music down cold. If I had any questions, I asked beforehand. My gear was top notch, the right choices for the gig.
Yep.
Nail the gig. And I already gave that present to myself because I was prepared. Mm-hmm. And then number five, leave everyone happy that you were there. If I do those things, only good things can happen. And I say that in the master classes, like, do that for 5 to 8 years and see what happens. I always knew that if I did that, I'd end up in a room with Sting and Peter Gabriel, and both of those things happen. You can kind of manifest some things in your life by the way that you control your path and your reputation.
Like you say in your master class, I'm not giving anything away here, you don't want to be Coors Light guy. That cracked me up when you said that.
Oh, you were the one guy that laughed at that. Cool.
Yeah, I was the guy. Everybody else stood there and went, huh? No, tell
Bart, Bart just needs to work on the part about everyone wanting to hang out with him.
I bought some of that Squatch soap. I don't know if you've seen those commercials, but it works. And people don't run anymore when I walk in the room. You know, it's amazing. Hey, so let's geek out here for a minute. I'm going to ask you a big question, because you've done videos and talk about your drum tech and the amazing drum set that you play and all that sort of stuff. Tell us about the drum kit, your drum tech, and all that sort of stuff. Let's geek out here for a minute, because I know the drummers will want to hear about that.
Well, I when I talk about drum techs, I have to start with on a sort of a somber note, because I lost Pauly Carrizo, who's my tech of 20 years ago, in March of 2 years ago, which was absolutely devastating to me and our whole organization. And in a beautiful stroke of luck, Mark Petricelli, who's been a friend for 20 years, was available to do it. So it was like family replacing family, you know what I mean? So it was to have had Pauly and now Mark, who knew Pauly, loved Pauly, and strives for his level of 100% excellence all the time, is an embarrassment of riches for me. So I'm very, very fortunate. So Mark is the custodian of, you know, Pauly's last drum set. And it's something that he takes very seriously. And, you know, we want to keep the drums and everything in tip-top shape on the road. And he's been batting 1,000 for me. And any tiny little microscopic thing that I'm like, hey, you know, we should do this, I could see it inside. He's like, damn it. I'm like, it's okay. But a funny thing happened, because if there's any video that was probably the most viewed, was when my snare drum went down in Renegade, and he played the snare drum in 30 seconds. Which seems like a long time when you're out there, but it was pretty darn quick. I told him, because he came up once before to fix something on the drums, and I could tell he had the little like, oh God, I gotta get this right. And I just said to him, I said, hey, don't come out there with the frantic shaky hands. Go out there cool as a cucumber, and you know, if something's falling down, fix it right the first time. Don't get up there and try to do it so fast that maybe you didn't really do it. Right. You know, breathe, relax. If you need to be out there for a whole song, I don't care. No one cares. Just take your time. And then lo and behold, I don't film every show, but I happened to be filming when I blew the snares off the bottom of the drum, and Mark came out, and it was a great moment captured on film. And I'm really, really proud of him. So that was
cool.
Yeah.
Good story.
That's awesome. And talk to us about the kit. What kind of kit is it? I know the brand, but what brand do you endorse, and what are the shells made of?
Well, the studio kit back here. Well, actually, I could take you around, can't I? I'm gonna turn on the lights for a moment. But it's basically the same kit on the road, different finish, and different gold. Sorry, I can't see. I'm gonna do this.
Yeah.
The Pearl Masterworks, wow. Black Limba. They're the maple gum, 6, 8, 10, 12 racks, 14, 16, 18 floors, and a gong drum. I wish I could play them for you, but they would just sort of cut out right now. But this is on.
Plus, you'd have to charge us a lot more.
Got a gold rack, and I got a beautiful Black Limba table from Artisan Customs. A Black Limba. This is one of the greatest things, by the way. I think every drummer should have one of these. Let's see. Can you see that?
Oh, I've seen that before. That is so awesome.
So this is the drum waiter from Kentville Drums, and he'll match your finish. You know, you got a Silver Sparkle kit, whatever you have it, Silver Sparkle. Beverages, drum key, something for your watch or your in-ears or your wallet, and your iPhone goes there, and it's connected. You know, you could connect it off your hi-hat stand. I just think it's the greatest thing, because I've stepped on two phones before. You know what I mean? Like you set up a gig, and then you throw your keys and wallet and your phone on the floor, like boom, everything's right there, and you'll never lose anything.
Cool. That's awesome.
David Betts asked, he said, I have to ask, how many snares?
At last count, I think it was around 136.
Wow.
Okay, on the snares, is that like a pawn shop find while you're on tour, or how's that happen?
You know, it's generally things that I fall in love with, and I have been gifted things, but I did purchase most of these drums in here. So there's the snare wall there, and then there's the snare wall over here. It goes up top, and then I got a bunch of drums behind me there. It's if I were to psychoanalyze myself here, I grew up in Chicago, and my father would take me to Drums Limited and Frank's Drum Shop. And you'd go up this elevator where there'd be this little old guy, like out of a David Lynch movie, that was running the elevator with, you know, the little hat. That's how I remember it anyway. And you know, the elevator doors would open and you'd walk in, and it was just floor to ceiling drums and gongs and chimes and cymbals, and you didn't know where to look or where to walk first. And I wanted to create that sort of sacred place for me out here. So when I come out here, I mean, just put a bullet in my head if I'm not inspired to play.
Right.
And if something's not happening, you know, change out the hi-hats, change out the snare drum. Go. That's the kit I learned to play on. That was my dad's kit.
No way. Really? That was your dad's kit?
Yeah, 1969 Slingerland with an 18-inch bass drum, which is incredibly rare. I didn't know that until about maybe 10, 15 years ago. But Slingerland, they didn't make a lot of 18s.
Huh.
So, yeah, this is, you know, when I come out here, you know, this is the view that you walk into from the front door. Yeah. And he's got another kit there. That's always sort of the third kit. You know, I'd set up whatever I want there.
That's amazing.
So
that is so cool.
I come out here and I'm immediately inspired, not only by all the drums, but all the stories, all the friends of mine, drum builders that have become friends, people that are no longer with us. You know, my dad's drums, my dad's old K right here.
Oh man,
you know, there's
vibrations,
molecules that are still, you know, shaking in there from my dad's touch. It's a very sacred place. And I just want to say this really quickly, if I may, and Bart, I may have said this at the master class, I say this at probably every other one. One thing that makes me really kind of makes my skin crawl is when I see someone on social media take a picture of their drums and say, "Here's my office tonight." I really hate that. It's not an office. It's not clever. It's not cute. I do this so I don't have to have an office.
Right. You
know, this is a sacred place. Don't denigrate the time, the hours of soul searching and working and small triumphs. Don't call that an office. I find that just absolutely disgusting. So that's my opinion. And the more you know, I guess. Please stop doing that.
I like what you just said. You said something really important that I think that every drummer needs to hear. You said hours of soul searching and small triumphs.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that, because my drum set's right here. I've got an E-kit right there. And I spend hours in here either teaching or just, you know, recording, whatever. This is my recording studio in my house. And there's so often that I walk out, never walk out defeated, but I walk out going, "Oh man, I know I could do that better." But then all of a sudden one day you'll sit down and you'll do it. And you'll sit down at the gig and it comes out and you're like, "Oh, That was it. I didn't try. It just came out of me." And I love that. Talk about that a little bit more, please. Expand upon that.
That's the secret of practicing, is just getting a little piece of the idea every day and coming more and more into focus until it's there. You know, drummers, musicians in general, but I think it's the case with drummers. They want this instant gratification, or they think that they're going to go down and, like, "I have all day Saturday. I'm going to go down for 6 hours and I'm going to," the brain and the body, I don't think, learns like that. You know, you just need to get a little piece of the idea every day with some daily practice. And even if there's a day that comes where you can't get to the kit, you know, whether you're walking the dog or you sit down and you're just going to kind of like, I'm going to close my eyes for like 5 minutes. If you can visualize something that you're working on, see them without moving your body, see the motions, hear it played perfectly, even though you're not physically practicing on the drums, I think you're a few more grains of sand closer to being able to internalize that the next time you get to the drums. I think there's a lot of validity in that
100%.
Visualizing it and hearing it the way that you want to hear it when you play it. So yeah, those are the small victories, because you have to take them in those little bite-sized morsels until you get to the point where, like you say, you get to the gig and there it is. Or then you record it and you're like, that's exactly how I wanted it to sound or feel. Those are sacred personal journeys. And that's why I'm like, here's my office tonight. It's vile to me, because that is the most sacred part of being a human, an artistic human for me. And to it's not clever or cute, you know, that is a sacred, sacred journey. And we should honor it and treat it as such.
Gene Hoagland, who's on our show, talked about practicing without picking up the drumsticks a lot, and talked about visualizing and imagining the music and imagining himself playing through songs without actually being at the kit, without actually having a pair of drumsticks in his hand. And I remember, and it totally resonated with me. I remember when I was in high school in my big band, and I would, you know, be working on the charts when I was going to sleep. I'd be lying in bed, imagining the tunes, you know, kind of air drumming as I'm going to sleep. And, you know, the brain's a big part of what you're developing, right? When you're practicing, it's not just about fast hands and hands and feet.
Yeah. No, so, to your point, I probably practice more on airplanes than I do in this room. Because I'll sit there, like the record that I just did for the guy in Switzerland, I would take drumless versions of those songs with just a click track, and I would sit there silently in my seat, and I kind of do this thing where I kind of move my fingers a little bit, so I'm kind of like, I probably look like some sort of like Rain Man guy. There was a lot, someone's really clocking me because I'm sitting there like, but I will hear the music, and I will hear what I want to hear.
Yeah. Right.
On this, and if there's been a discussion with the artist of what the type of thing that they want to hear. So I will start with that. Communication is always key. That's a whole side story to this, but I will learn music on airplanes like that and develop ideas, so that when I get to the kit, I already have a really pretty clear, more than charcoal sketch of where I want to start.
That's right. My dear friend, Stevie. Well, you know Stevie D, Todd.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, he's his computer's right there. I bought it from him.
I love Stevie. I love him.
He is so incredible. And that's, you know, he said the same thing. He's like, I learned so many songs on the plane. You know, I'm sitting there on the plane and I'm learning a tune. That's brilliant. That's because you're visualizing it, and you're also, when you do that, are you kind of hearing your tone, your inflection, your snare drum, your cymbals on it as well? Kind of your life in it, or trying to, at least?
If I know I'm going to have that sort of freedom, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
But sometimes you are fulfilling a different task. Like, I got the call to play on Brian Wilson's That Lucky Old Son the day before. They called me at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they said, are you available to come to Los Angeles tomorrow to record? And I was, you know, just woke up. I'm like, yes, but I need to be in Boise the day after. And they're like, we'll call you back. And then they called me back, and boom, they, you know, emailed me the whole record. So I had that one day at home. And then the plane ride from Austin to Los Angeles went right into Capitol and did the whole record in one day, and was leaving Capitol by 8:30 at night, then flew to Boise the next day. But I also knew that I had to fill a void of what that music was that was written, because they had actually, with That Lucky Old Son, they had debuted it live in London at Royal Festival Hall. So I had to listen to what Jim Hines had played, because they, you know, I know they want this sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
So now it's a matter of pleasing Brian. And then when Brian works in the studio, he's calling stuff, you know, do this, don't do that. Hey, when you get here, stop. So it's all on the fly. So yeah, I mean, wow. But also when you're a session musician, you have to be able to take direction. And if someone says, we're going to do it like this, and it's completely, you know, the photo opposite negative of what you had sort of prepared in your mind, you have to be able to adapt and make it happen, you know, right quick, you know, or you're not going to be there long.
Mark, I actually really like your question about, you know, does Todd imagine hearing his tone and the sound, you know, the sonic impact of his kid and not just the part. You know, people, I think drummers get really hung up on, you know, what is the part? It's like, what is the plot? You know, and that's all good and fine, but like how you deliver it is really what makes all the difference. And like you're saying, Todd, you know, you've got to, if you're filling someone else's shoes or you're playing a recording that's already been done and you're, you know, or it's been played live and then you have to record it, it's not just about hearing what you want to hear. You've got to be conscious and thoughtful about what it already sounded like, what they're used to, what they're expecting.
Yeah, because ultimately we're in the service industry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if a producer said to me, hey, could we take the front head of the bass drum off? Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but to go like, hey, man, no, that's not my thing. That's not my sound. Yeah. Right there, what I'm doing is I'm saying, this guy's never going to hire me again.
Right, right.
Because I've now brought that sort of vibe into the situation. You want me to do something? Sure. I may, in deep down, may not want to do it or wouldn't be my call, but it isn't my call. It's their call. And it's my job to make them happy and bring their vision into the reality that they want to see that works for them, not cool stuff that works for me as the drummer on the session.
But you must also get hired frequently for just like, you know, there are no preconceived notions of what the drum track's supposed to be. We're hiring Todd because of his instincts and his touch and his feel, just like, you know, we might hire Steve Gadd or Vinny or whatever.
Not so much anymore, because demos have very detailed drum programming or samples. It's been a long time since someone came to me with like, here's this, here it goes with like an acoustic guitar.
Right.
That used to happen a lot. And there's a different type of chops where you go into a session and you never heard the song. You never met these people before. Here's the song or here's what we have. And then you have to, you know, you got to paint the Mona Lisa on this.
Right.
But generally how sessions work for me in the 21st century is they've lived with these demos and they have some sort of preconceived notion. And so they send it to me with their drums. And then I always say, send me, you know, a file with drumless. And then we talk about, is there anything on your demo that you need to hear, like the same type of snare drum sound, whether it's low or high? Is there a fill that you're like, I kind of have to have that there? So that way I know if they're completely married to some ideas or they're open to interpretation and trust me to deliver what I think is right. And then we can talk about it afterwards. I had an interesting session when I first worked with this guy in Germany called Finally George. I played on two of his records and they're brilliant records. I mean, if you like sort of, you know, Pink Floyd, Porcupine Tree stuff, like just really, really great music. But the first track he sent me, something in a section was in 11. And I changed the groove because his drum machine groove sounded drum machine-y to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first track I did from a sent it to him. We're doing a FaceTime. And he goes, you opened up the hi-hat on 10 only when I had it on 9 and 10.
Wow.
And I thought, oh boy, this is going to be a long experience. But I explained to him, I said, that sounded like a drum machine to me. That didn't sound the way a natural drummer. And he considered it and thought, okay. And then we moved on. And then he was, and because he'd lived with that piece of music for 3 years.
Right.
So some people they have demo-itis. So you could get, you know, Vinny to play on something, and because it's not the same everything in the same snare drum sound, it's like they're seeing the Eiffel Tower, but it's in lipstick red now. The Eiffel Tower, but what was okay? They have to get over the demo-itis and be open to, well, this is new. We're in Technicolor now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you have to kind of earn their trust, is what you're saying on like that. Obviously,
ultimately, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Todd, when you went to California and you had to go to Boise, Mark Stevens, our friend, asked, "What did you have to come to Boise for?"
A Styx gig. Yeah, so I had to, you know, whatever our organization had to eat the Austin to Boise plane ticket, and Brian Wilson organization had to buy me a one way from Los Angeles to Boise.
Todd, let's talk about earlier in your career.
A potato eating festival would have been a much more entertaining answer.
That's what I was hoping for. I was hoping for a hot dog. You know,
missed opportunity. Yeah,
potato. Sorry, yeah. Maybe a potato watching.
It was a swing and a miss.
By a
mile. Anyway, when you were how old were you when you started playing drums? Really, you're young, right?
I was two.
Two, and your dad was a sort of drummer by night. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a doctor by day and a drummer by night.
And so you grew up around music all the time. You're playing when you were very young. Did you take lessons?
Well, yes. I mean, the greatest gift I think I ever received was being the youngest in a musical family. My mm-hmm. father was a great big band drummer, and he was 50 when I was born. So, I mean, he gigged in the 30s, 40s, 50s, slow down a little bit in the 60s. My mother was an actress who could sing and play the piano, and I had two older brothers, Paul and Joel, five and 7 years older than me. And Paul was a gifted piano player, and Joel played bass, and I fell in love with the drums. And so we rounded out a rhythm section and grew up, you know, we'd go have a swim, then we'd go work on some music or throw a ball around, come back. And music and comedy and sports were the three things that were always revolving in our house. And we had a stereo in every room, so you could come in and there might be Count Basie coming from one room and Led Zeppelin coming from another. It was such a great way to grow up. What a gift. And then to have, my father teach me how to play. My two older brothers paved the way for me all the way through school, where I was invited to be in the junior high jazz band when I was in first grade. So I actually have the dubious honor of spending 8 years in the junior high band. School District 74, a record still unbroken.
Outstanding.
That's awesome.
You know, in the same way through high school, when my brothers got to high school, you know, as freshmen, they made friends with the hot horn players that were seniors, and then they had older friends. And so I was pulled into these professional situations where I was playing, mm-hmm. Weddings and bar mitzvahs and parties and, whatnot. From the time I was eight or nine, it was great.
And then you went to Berkeley for music school, right?
I went to Berkeley for 1 year, 87, 88, two semesters, ran out of money and came home.
Boy, that's such a common story I hear. I have so many friends who went to Berkeley for a year and they're like, they got what they wanted or ran out of money. And that was that back then.
I think that there's a kind of a secret club of 1 year folks.
Right.
There's some sort of, not to name drop, but I remember Vinny Caliuta high-fived me when I went for 1 year. It's like, me too, and he gave me a big best high five ever. It was great. I mean, I hold those 9 months very close to my heart, and I still have many great friends and friends with a few of the teachers I had there. So it was a meaningful time.
And you're also, in addition to all your busy recording projects and you're touring with Styx, you travel around the country giving drum clinics and master classes. Yes.
Yeah, not so much clinics anymore. Those have gone the way of the dinosaur a little bit. But the master class thing I find much more rewarding because it's just me and the host. You know, it's normally a drum shop and students that are very eager to learn. And it's all about education. We're a clinic, and I'm not dissing clinics. Clinics are great, and I had great experiences with clinics as a kid going to see my heroes. Mm-hmm. But you know, let's face it, clinics are a sales-driven event sponsored by the drum, cymbal, head, mic, knickknack companies, and the drum shop. And ultimately, it's here's the drums, here are the drums, buy the drums. Where a masterclass is all about real deal education and things that took me a long time to learn that I could put people on the fast track to improving at a much faster rate, because there's a lot of things, and I say this with no arrogance, there's a lot of things I thought that were common knowledge that are not. The more I got out there and taught and did drum camps and drum fantasy camp and a couple of things like that in Europe, where drummers were doing things physically and mentally that were keeping them from being able to improve. And I was able to see and recognize and diagnose this. So I really, really enjoy going out and spending time with drummers who have always been my best friends and my favorite people in my tribe, and trying to make their life with this, our shared interest, better. From this point out, I'm very passionate about that, and it's incredible fun for me.
That's so awesome. I have two questions. Sorry, Jeremy. I've got two questions. I'm going to throw at you. You just said there's a mental block holding some people back. That's something that we've talked about here. What is that mental block? And the second question is, and I'm asking for myself, if one finds himself in Austin, Texas, can they take a private lesson with you? Is that something you still do? Because you said that somebody was in there taking a lesson one time.
Yes. I haven't done any privates here since probably 2019. I probably will again, but you know, one of the great lessons of 2020 for me in the 16 months that I was home here was that I really want to spend time here for me. And when I teach, I like going out and doing the master classes. So, you know, there's going to be a time in the future, I don't know when that will be, where, you know, my band won't be in existence anymore. And I'll want to be spending more time here. And I kind of see my third act being teaching like that, unless something, you know, that I've unforeseen happens to me. But I after almost 30 years on the road, you know, I could maybe do another 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you guys went away here.
Uh-oh. We're still here if you can hear us.
Yeah, let me, you're disappeared on my screen. But, let me try to figure this out. There you go. And we're back.
Todd, James B. Harrison said, I brought Todd to Boise many years ago after seeing him do a PASIC clinic. I had him come in for the Idaho Day of Percussion. James Harrison says, hi. Jacob Tosa says he's looking forward to seeing you come to Rupp's Drums in Denver. It'll be on his 35th birthday. And Alex Austinson says, with Ricky retiring and Sticks, curious on the process of replacements, et cetera, or general comments.
First off, hey, James, great to hear from you, man, and hope you're well. What was the middle comment again?
The middle one was Jacob Sosa's looking forward to seeing you come to Rupp's Drums in Denver. It'll be on his 35th birthday.
Yes. Well, I'll be there the night, was it the 24th? I'll be at Rupp's, and then we're playing, I think, the Pepsi Center the next night. So you can,
right,
you can come to the masterclass and then take in a show the next night. Right now Terry Gowan is playing bass with us, who's Lawrence Gowan's brother, who's very much overqualified for the job. He's a brilliant musician, great bass player, great keyboard player, great singer, great musician all around. So with Ricky retiring from the road, Terry was the first thought, the first call, also because when I would do Lawrence Gowan's solo thing, the three of us played together going back to 2010. So he's a known entity on stage and off, and there's pictures of the three of us together. So it was like sort of bringing someone that's been in the family into the family, as opposed to here's so-and-so.
Yeah.
that no one knows. It made sense, and it was a natural progression. And the six shows we've just done with Terry were went off absolutely beautifully. So, thank you.
That's awesome.
Very good. Okay, so again, I'm going to be self-serving here. The second half of my question: what is the mental block? You said you see a lot of drummers have a mental block, or something like that. What is that? Talk about that a little bit. That always fascinates us.
Well, it's basically fear-based. Absolute fear, or the fake concern of judgment, or the constant comparison. Right. And if you bring, you know, sort of this dark cloud of those three things to this sacred throne, it's really hard for the magic of music to find you, because you've created sort of a panic driven nightmare in your head that's going to affect your thought process, your synapses, your brain, a hand and feet, your ability to hear better, the music, to hear calmer. So these are things, though they don't sound tremendously exciting, these are things that we talk about in the master classes, because they are a thing that is keeping people from being their authentic self and being who they could be on this instrument. You know, if you're going in for a band audition, and you're thinking, oh, geez, oh, God, I hope I get this. I really want this gig. And you go in there with, you know, hands are shaking and butterflies in the stomach, and you're not listening or taking direction. And maybe, you crash your car into a tree. What you don't realize is the band is going, oh, God, please send us a drummer. We've heard 30 people, and this is killing us.
Yeah.
They're on their hands and knees with a gun to their head, hoping that you're the guy. So if you walk in there and you screw it up yourself, that's the reality of the situation. They're hoping it's you. So go in there, right, and relax, listen, have big ears, have a big heart and a big brain, and be a good hang and get the gig. And if you don't get the gig, it's because you weren't what they were looking for, and it wasn't right. And then you can go, that's showbiz. But to walk out of there for the rest of your life going, I blew it. Well, right, you did that to yourself. So again, these are things that we talk about in the masterclass that are huge, huge obstacles that, you know, I would say 9 out of 10 musicians or drummers just jail themselves with this thought process that they will never get as good as they could be because of this nonsense that they made up and they held on to. Dead baggage for no reason.
Yeah, I like to refer to that as the path of least resistance. You know, we often talk about the path of least resistance being a good thing, and you're always wanting to go that way, but it's reflexive for a lot of us, where, you know, we have those negative thoughts where we're judging ourselves, we're fear-based. And if you sort of don't catch yourself, that's just going to be the cycle that you get stuck in. And your best playing never comes from that headspace.
And that kind of, that's like that one show that we did. We did a whole show on you know, imposter syndrome, and how you it's so easy to get stuck in imposter syndrome. You know, you're sitting here, you know, oh my God, we're on with Todd Zuckerman, you know, and freak out. I I'm not good enough. And that's kind of what you're hitting at, right, Todd? I mean, like you get into that place where you're like, I'm not as good as that guy, but you're not embracing your own journey at that point.
Well, the other thing also, like I have this a lot with my students who come in and they tell me about these shows that they go and see, and they're talking about how this drummer was better than them or whatever it was. And I'm like, hey man, if the whole time that you're listening to a band, all you're thinking about is comparing yourself to the drummer you're hearing, you're not even giving them like the respect of listening to their music. You can even tell me how the show was or what happened in the show or the moments between the guitar player. If all you're sitting there, you're stuck making comparisons. And again, it's like, how does that help you? Right.
You can't treat this like a sport. You can't treat this like a better than, or like, you know, the longest shot put was, you know, there's no measurements for this.
It's art.
So if you like Meg White better than Carter Beauford, well, then that's your thing.
Right.
But It's important. The one thing one of many things is to try to be yourself. When someone gets up and plays for me, and they play an obvious tune, they play Tom Sawyer, or they play Grand Illusion, something like that. Don't do that, because that's not you. I want to hear what you have to say. You know, I don't want to hang out with friends and have them repeat, you know, Lady Chatterley or novels to me like this. We're not hanging out. What's in your mind? I want to know what that is. So, that's another thing. You know, if someone gets up and plays Roseanne, I'm like, you know, it's a masterclass. Like, what do you have to say?
I like that at the masterclass I don't want to give anything away, but you said, I want you to play this for this amount of time. There, I didn't give away anything for anybody that might come to your masterclass. And getting up there and doing it and just, okay, here it is. That's what you asked for. I gave it to you. And then listening to the other people do it, it's very eye-opening. It really is. It's very, for myself, I didn't feel put on the spot. I felt more like, okay, I'm just going to give you what you asked for. And I'm not going to give you more than you asked for or less. I'm just going to try to do what you said, kind of like you were saying with the sessions, I guess. I don't know. But I think that's important to be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we're getting dangerously close to giving some things away.
Sorry.
because I want to.
Yeah, I know. I apologize.
Because there are experiments that we conduct in the master classes that need to be gone into without any preparation, that are, you know, the element of surprise is part of it. So, but that is always a great musical and anthropological study, right, as to why drummers choose certain things at certain times when certain things were requested of them. And then we talk about, well, what just happened here?
Right.
And I think that's a pretty eye-opening experience. I know it would be for me if I went in and did something and then didn't, you know, if Steve Smith asked me to do something and I went and I didn't do it, I'd be replaying that over in my head for a long time.
Right. Yeah.
But I also, it's not like I'm jamming his dog's nose in the pile or something like that. We talk about it, and we talk about why and how did this happen? Not shame on you for doing this, but right. how did we get here? Well,
how can you learn from it? You know, that's the feeling. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time, and we have the most important question to ask you now that we ask every drummer. We've asked Dom Famularo, God rest his soul. We've asked everybody. In your neck of the woods, outside of Austin, where's the best place to get pizza?
In Austin?
Well, around you. Just where's the best place to get pizza around you? It could be Chicago. You're from Chicago. I mean, you know.
Well, there's always Lou Malnati's thick and thin in my freezer. So definitely what the best place to get pizza is over there.
What time do you guys open?
Yeah.
24 hours. This is really funny. That same night, we were talking earlier about Fredericksburg, Texas. That same night when we drove through this place, said Yagi's New York Pizza. And I said, in Austin back then, you could still dial 7 digits. You didn't need the
area code,
which I thought was really kind of beautiful. And it said 402-0202. And that was the first thing I learned, even before I went through the gates, like 402-0202, we're going to need that. And so Yagi's New York Pizza is sort of legit New York pizza here. But being that I'm from Chicago, I'm partial to Chicago. But unlike most New Yorkers, I love all sorts of pizza. Or New Yorkers, for some reason, hold on to their pizza and they got a crap on Chicago pizza. Like, come on, it's a big world. It's all you're New York, right?
I can't hear you. What's that you're saying?
You're New York. You don't have to, you're New York. But it's also a big world in there, and other people can have good pizza too.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Awesome.
Okay. May I try to really quick, if anyone's interested in coming to a masterclass, to see if I could.
Yes, listen. Please.
The location's coming up, and go to my Facebook website, toddsuckerman.com. I don't have all of them posted yet, but I'm doing two in Detroit next week, then Dallas, Washington, D.C., Seattle, Portland, Dublin, California.
Oh, yeah.
And in May, and sorry if I forget any of these, May is going to be Calgary, Vancouver, Regina, Ottawa, Halifax, Montreal, and then later in the summer, we're going to be doing Denver, Cincinnati, Toronto, wow. And a few others. So, hit me up, and it'd be great to have you come out if you're interested and spend 3 hours in a small group, and come on out. You'll be glad that you did.
It's a lot of fun. Your masterclass was fantastic, and I really had a great time. Yeah.
Do those master classes coincide with the tour? Like you give the classes in all the cities where the band stops?
Generally, no. Most of them are done in my, that's how I spend my free time. But the summer will be on nights off of the tour.
Cool.
That's actually not two of the Canadian ones when we're out east are going to be on the Styx run as well. So it's nice if I'm able to do that. But it's not always an easy thing to do.
Right.
I might book it and they may be, oh no, we're not going to be spending our night off there. We're going to be flying in. And then I got to figure that out.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's actually easier if I'm unencumbered by plans that would change that I would have nothing to do with.
Got it. Todd, thank you so much for spending an hour with us and sharing all your wisdom and great vibes, man. We really appreciate you coming on and talking to us.
You guys were a ton of fun, and it was absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for letting me ramble on.
Yeah,
we're you all ready for it.
All right, guys. Well, we'll see you next week. What do we have on tap for next week, Bart?
Next week we have nothing. We're shooting from the hip, so we got nothing. I'm gonna like bomb Todd's Facebook, please come back on, and he'll block me and it'll be terribly ugly. But no, we'll figure something out between now and then. And don't forget about Deck Day coming up on April 20th. We will be up in the Oakland area at Bandworks, and that's what we got for right now, but we'll see you guys next week.
All right, thanks everybody.
Thanks, guys. Everybody, bye. We'll see you next